Radio.
Catholic Spirituality and Mental Health. A talk by Dr. Philippa Marta for the Dawson Society.
Tom forgot to mention I'm also very, very small. Which is good because you'll be able to hear me but just not see me. Off we go, wacko, that's marvellous. All righty. Can you hear me, by the way? Can everybody hear me? That's good. Okay. Right, well, the first thing I have to say is this talk I will give this evening, this is like the reverse word from our sponsor. This talk I will give tonight consists entirely of my own opinions. It's not the opinions of the WA Department of Health, nor of North Metropolitan Health Service Mental Health, who are my employers, nor is it to be construed in any way as a criticism of current services and treatments delivered by North Metro. They work within a particular paradigm, often with very limited resources and with some particularly complex clients, and I can assure you, because I'm there every day, that they are doing absolutely the best job they know how to do. I'm also not a clinician, so if you've come here looking for free psychological or psychiatric advice, I can't give it. Don't get me wrong, I am going to give you advice. I adore giving people advice. This audience is full of people to whom I've given advice. It's usually advice I've been given myself but never used, so I can hand it over to you in mint condition. It's actually quite hard to know where to start with a topic like this and an audience like this. You're all from very different backgrounds. And you all have different reasons for being here tonight, and it's also a very personal topic for a lot of people. So what I thought we would do tonight is start with a bit of clarification about the current state of psychiatric and mental health research generally, and after that we can begin to unpack some alternative ways of thinking about mental health and mental illness that I think are very applicable and very workable, and which have a special relationship with our Catholic intellectual heritage. Now, before we go any further, I have some mental health warnings. The first one is I'm talking about and to adults this evening. Can you see the PowerPoint over there? Good. The whole area of mental health intervention with children and adolescents is a really controversial one. I am not going there this evening. That doesn't mean that I'm going to say anything that children can't hear. If there's anyone here under 18, you're very welcome to stay. The second thing is drop your weapons. I don't recommend you approach this topic looking for things to use as weapons against troublesome people in your life. And I hate even having to say this, but I'm going to say it up front. I do understand that when you have to live with someone who has mental health problems, they can test your patience and your love to extraordinary lengths, and they can also be abusive and manipulative. And sometimes these people marry each other, and then the whole family gets to enjoy what it's like to have a mental illness. So what I'm saying with that is try to look for things this evening that apply to you, not to other people straight away. It should be about actually you and where you are. The third thing is it physical? I'm talking tonight about the kinds of disorders we call high prevalence, so anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsion, personality disorders. There are some people who don't fit into this scope. They have acquired organic brain injuries, they have brain damage from alcohol and drug use, these sorts of things. They really need different help from what I'll be talking about. Some people also have emotional problems that relate to a specific medical condition. So thyroid disorder, that's a huge one, hormone problems, and heart disease. They all come with particular emotional burdens as well. Obviously, I'd recommend that anyone who's having emotional or psychological problems should, first of all, have a very thorough physical checkup with a good doctor before they're ever given any diagnosis of a mental illness. And it is amazing how often this doesn't happen. Finally, don't write this down. Now, what I mean by that is basically don't feel you have to make copious notes. If you want to know what I said, I'll send you a copy of the paper. I have a reference list for this talk, which you can pick up at the door. That's the really crunchy scientific stuff if you want to know where my scientific basis is. But I also have something which I call the DIY list, which is a whole lot of further reading and resources and suggestions about a whole range of topics to do with what I'm talking about tonight. And you can pick that up at the end of this evening as well if you want to take it. And we're recording this as well. So why me? What is someone who originally trained as a medical historian doing talking to you about mental health and illness from a Catholic perspective? There's a couple of reasons for this. Firstly, I'm a historian, and that means I'm interested in watching the way in which medical practice changes over time. And psychiatry is a gift for someone like me because it's got a really short history, so you can watch all of the major changes happen in about a 100-year period. I've also spent the last 6 years working in a mental health clinical research centre, and my job involved me specifically reading a huge amount of psychiatric research. What I do for my job, for those of you who are curious, is that I translate research findings into basically English for a range of audiences. I write reports, I analyse other people's reports, I help develop policy, and I do service planning as well. In this process, I learned how ordinary people receive information about mental health. They receive it through a whole lot of filters, which makes things sound a lot more certain than they are in reality. This is scientific findings and so forth. The reason we believe that modern science has pretty much got mental health in the bag is because of public relations people. And I can say that with my hand on my heart because I've done this work myself. You get given a piece of research, you're said, right, now explain this to this consumer group. So you take the research, it's full of ifs and buts and maybes, and it's very qualified, but you have to turn it into researchers have found that, and you make it sound as if there's a miracle treatment just around the corner. You also have to do this for media releases as well. So what I've learned in the last 6 years about psychiatric research can actually be summarised in one phrase, and that phrase is, the science is not settled. I put together a list of what I think most people think about mental health and mental health research and so forth. This is pretty much a list of how I used to think about this topic about 6 years ago. Psychiatric researchers know how the brain works. And they know what causes most mental illnesses. They're caused by chemical imbalances in the brain. They usually run in families. They're often a genetic component. The drugs are safe. They're much better than they used to be, and you can use them over long periods of time without any problems. They're the best option for most people. And they cure the chemical imbalance that causes the mental illness. And that is actually how most people do think about psychiatric research. They think, yeah, that's a fairly good summary of the state of play. Now, would you like to know what the actual truth is? This is the stuff I discovered in the last 6 years. Researchers don't know how the human brain works. They don't have a clue. We do not know the etiology of most mental illnesses at all. There are theories, and the people will argue about the theories till the cows come home and insist that they have proven their theory, but actually no one has proven their theory. The genetic effect may be significantly less than we are used to thinking that it is, and that's because of very large population-based studies that are now being done by epidemiologists. There are very few long-term studies of the effects of these drugs on various people. The drugs don't cure chemical imbalances. They create chemical imbalances that produce behavioural and emotional changes. Now, I was very surprised to learn these things, and I know other people have been very surprised when I've talked to them about this kind of stuff. It shouldn't be surprising because research thrives on disagreement and changing hypotheses and new data coming in all the time. It's healthy. This is how the scientific method works. We should be arguing about this stuff. But what has this got to do with Catholic spirituality? Again, there's two things. Firstly, I found that there's stuff emerging from this field which seems to dovetail with existing very traditional Catholic ideas of the human person and what makes us happy or unhappy. The second thing is that I found that practicing Catholics who suffer from these emotional and psychological problems are often very confused about why they have these problems and how they should go about addressing them, if indeed they should address them at all. We might end up going to confession or to a spiritual director with an emotional problem, and then we go and see a psychologist with what is really a spiritual problem. We seem to have lost our ability to tell one set of problems from the other. And I found, just from talking and listening to various people on this topic, and it's been about 20 years now that I've been having this conversation with people, that there are two broad Catholic approaches to mental illness. Now, I am broadly, grossly oversimplifying here, so please don't be offended if you find you don't fit into either of these schools. It is a bit of a caricature. The first school is the one I call take your pills and offer it up. This school of thought says, yes, anyone can get a mental illness. It's not your fault. There's drugs for them. Drugs are probably the best treatment, and therapy will sort out anything for you that the drugs can't. These are the people who tend to tell you that various saints suffered from mental illness. Beware these people. I am a medical historian. We do retrospective diagnosis for fun. We don't expect it to be taken seriously. You can't take it seriously. You can't diagnose a person with anything unless they're in the room with you. So please don't take that seriously. Also, these people often don't distinguish between saints who had emotional problems before they had a major conversion and saints who had spiritual trials after they had a major conversion. And we're talking about two different things there. So that's one approach. The other approach I like to call psychological seduction. This approach is very suspicious of psychiatry and psychology. Therapy is all about making you feel good about yourself, and it absolves you from blame. It's secular confession. Drugs are often a big no-no to these people in this model. Confession and prayer should sort your problems out, and if they don't, you're probably possessed and or it is the will of God, and you must can't be helped. Now, as a practicing Catholic and a working mental health researcher, I find both of these approaches very unsatisfactory. I know many practicing Catholics are afraid to approach secular psychologists because they think they'll be lectured about their religion or told that their repressive attitude to sex is making them crazy. And I have to admit that I have encountered exactly those attitudes, but I've never encountered them from psychologists, always been older psychiatrists who seem to have this bugbear about religion. I do acknowledge that there's probably people in the audience who've had very bad experiences that I haven't had. I have seen good practicing Catholic people get real help from competent psychologists, and the psychologist doesn't need to be a Catholic either. I'm just going to do a quick clarification to make sure we all know what we're talking about. The psychiatrists are the ones who do the drug bit, okay? They're the ones with the medical qualification. Psychologists are the ones who do the talking therapies and other clinical interventions, and counsellors are the ones who mostly do the listening, the talking, listening kinds of therapies. That's just to make sure we all know there's a difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist. So where do we go from here? The good news is I have lots to tell you, which I hope will challenge you and invigorate you and probably annoy you and give you a fresh perspective on how Catholics might be able to understand what we call mental illness and what it might mean for us spiritually and how our Catholic theological heritage can offer us some real hope of recovery from mental illness if individuals are willing to do some work with God's help. So given that currently the science is not settled about the origin of most mental illnesses, and given also that the more we learn about the human brain and body, the more it seems to confirm ideas that Catholics have actually believed in for a long time, now seems like a good idea to look at these ideas, look at Catholic ideas about the origins of mental illness and how we can address this. And I'm going to do this by introducing you to a sequence of ideas that I have found very helpful, and particularly one Catholic writer who I've found very helpful. On the way there, we're just going to look at some ideas put forward by two other secular writers, and these are only two writers out of the hundreds who've written about psychiatry and so forth. The first writer is one whom some of you may have heard of. It's a book which was published originally in 1961. It's by psychiatrist Dr. Thomas Sars, and it's called The Myth of Mental Illness. Has anyone heard of this book? Yay! Here's a copy. This is what it looks like. It's a bit beaten up because I've read it a lot, so... The Myth of Mental Illness. What an interesting title that is, and it instantly gets people's hackles up. Now, when this book was published, a lot of the immediate reaction was to dismiss Sars and his arguments out of hand. And admittedly, there's some holes in there, in some parts of his argument. But on the whole, psychiatry as a profession has found it very hard to refute Sars because he was actually fundamentally correct about a great many things to do with psychiatry, and the subsequent 50 years after this book is published has proved him to be correct. Some Catholics don't like Sars because he is no friend to the Catholic Church, so I'm just warning you about that. But I do want to get beyond that because one of his core ideas is very, very useful. And that core idea is actually right in front of you, but most people miss it. It's this, the book's subtitle, Foundations of a Theory of Personal Conduct. Sars argues, in a nutshell, that mental illness makes no sense as a concept. People can have physical illnesses, with delirium and hallucinations and other things, but they're physical illnesses and they should be treated by general medicine and neurology and psychiatry. But everything else he calls problems in living. It's worth considering that phrase for a while and just letting that sink in. Sars argued back in 1961 that psychiatry was becoming too medicalised. Instead of helping people with problems in living, psychiatry tried to treat people as if they had physical illnesses that needed hospitalisation and drugs. Saz's core message instead is that of personal agency and individual responsibility. He argues very convincingly that the individual is the one who has the most control over their mental and emotional health, and therefore they are the one who is best placed to find their way out of their personal maze of problems. Now, as you can imagine, Saz's ideas were really unpopular back in 1961, but they actually drove a number of really important reforms within psychiatry. Because of Saz, today it's much easier to find psychiatrists who are open about the failures of psychiatry and about the lack of evidence base for various diagnoses and their lack of knowledge of the origins of most mental illnesses. Anyway, there's lots of interesting stuff in this book. I don't want to spend too long on it before we move on, but it's that idea of personal responsibility and personal conduct that I just want you to hang on to for now. Before we go any further, I do want to say a few things about psychiatric drugs. Four things about drugs, and here they are. Firstly, questions about drug safety should not be dismissed as some kind of half-baked conspiracy theory dreamt up by Scientologists. There are legitimate, seriously, honest to God, it's not just them. There are legitimate concerns within psychiatry itself about the safety and long-term use of psychiatric drugs. And these concerns have been expressed publicly for decades. This is not secret information, I am telling you. This has all been published. It's not all one-way traffic. Psychiatrists admit that sometimes they prescribe because they simply don't know what else to do, or they feel pressured by the patient, or because they feel that if they don't prescribe, they are a bad doctor. Most of these drugs have noticeable physical side effects, some of which can be quite exciting and indeed unpleasant. Some of them are potentially risky. Antipsychotics, the second generation antipsychotics, are linked with something called metabolic syndrome, whereby a person can enormously increase their risk of developing diabetes and cardiovascular disease. In a nutshell, psychiatric drugs don't cure anything, but they do control or modify feelings and behaviours that are problematic, either for the person or for the people around the person. We now know a lot more about these drugs and their effects because there's some long-term studies that are now becoming available. But we also know that things like physical exercise and some cognitive therapies and some placebos work better than most antidepressants. Researchers who argue that chemical imbalances are the cause of mental illnesses have not yet been able to prove their theories. So, do physical changes in our brain and body cause our emotional and psychological problems, or do our emotional problems cause those physical changes? Which brings me to my second book, which is a book many of you may be familiar with, I hope so, Norman Doidge's very readable study, The Brain That Changes Itself. Are you familiar with this book at all? Good. Yeah, it's very, very good. It's a really good read. Doidge is a psychiatrist, like Thomas Saz again. He's a psychoanalyst and he's also an academic researcher. And his concept that he puts forward in this book is that of neuroplasticity. It's not really his concept, but he's probably the chief apostle of it. Neuroplasticity is the concept that an individual brain can and does physically change over time, and that things we do with our bodies and our thoughts are capable of changing the brain's physical structure. And this book certainly has got numerous clinical examples of what look like miracles. For 400 years, researchers thought that brain architecture was hardwired. This led people to believe that lots of other things about human beings were also hardwired, like personality and handedness and sexual preference and all sorts of other things. We were wrong, completely and utterly wrong. Not only that, each person's individual brain appears to have its own architecture that can change over time. We may actually all be neurologically unique. Neuroplasticity radically changes our understanding of the origins of mental illness, because we can see using it how powerful emotions and experiences like love, sex, grief, relationships, addictions, and some therapies can physically change our brains. And it should also open our eyes to the dangers to which we expose our brains when we engage in harmful behaviours. And this includes behaviours that don't always feel very harmful, like high-stimulus computer games and pornography. Neuroplasticity also helps to explain why cognitive behavioural therapies seem to work so well for so many mental illnesses. And they're now being tried for the illnesses at the serious end of the scale, like bipolar disorders and schizophrenia. It's a question of laying down a new positive brain map which replaces an old negative one. Now, again, I think this is a book you can read for yourselves, and I hope you will do. But there are key messages in it which I just want to pull out because they're important for what I'm going to say tonight. The first message is, like that of Thomas Sowers, personal individual agency. And this approach puts the focus back on the person and their capacity to participate actively in their own recovery rather than just remaining some kind of passive patient. According to neuroplastic theory as well, our choices have the potential to affect our mental health dramatically. We can make ourselves mentally unhealthy, but we are also the key player in the task of recovery. I see this as extremely countercultural because we can be very passive when we get emotional and psychological problems. We are kind of trained to go to the doctor, get a diagnosis, be told it's an illness, get the drugs, go away and take them, and then dot, dot, dot. Sometimes we get better, sometimes we don't. And yet writers like Sowers and Deutsch, although coming from completely different directions, tell us the opposite. They tell us that our life choices can make us mentally healthy or mentally unhealthy. Now, other people's behaviours can and do affect our mental health as well, and we do sometimes need help from other people to get back on track, and I'll speak about that later. But we have the primary role in maintaining our mental health and finding it again if we've lost it. So how do you get your mental health back once it's lost? Well, for both Sowers and Deutsch, there is a road back, but it involves hard work. For Sowers, the process involves learning to communicate painful truths instead of acting them out with disruptive and damaging behaviours. That's his theory behind mental illness, that it's a form of mime, a form of attempts to communicate things which can't be articulated. For Deutsch, the process is this really full-on brain remodelling that involves repetition over days and weeks and months. It's very intensive. Some people get better more quickly than others, but all of us need help and we need persistence if we want to do these things. And this is, of course, what puts people off. There is a systemic problem here as well in that it's much cheaper and quicker and easier to give people drugs. But drugs don't cure anything. These other treatments and therapies will produce measurable and positive differences. They teach people useful recovery skills, they increase their resilience, but they take time and effort and they cost more money to do. They also require commitment, and we are a soft society. And it's because we're so unwilling to suffer any kind of discomfort, like making a commitment or having to do something we don't like, that's part of the reason we've embraced the concept of mental illness so enthusiastically and for such a range of very first world problems that can cause us such disproportionate pain. And yet, of course, pain is a warning system. Pain is God's megaphone, C.S. Lewis says, and he's exactly right. When the body is in pain, it's telling us something. When your emotions are causing you pain, they are telling you something. Now, in either case, we tend to make one or more of three choices. They look like this. This is the first choice. We ignore the pain and we try to continue as normal, but we're horrible to everyone around us because actually we're in pain all the time. We don't function well. We feel rotten. The second thing we can do is we can dope ourselves up. We can use drugs to remove the pain, but then we keep going as normal. And of course, walking on a broken leg doesn't help it. And going to work with the flu doesn't help anybody else. The third thing you can do is, of course, address the cause of the pain and fix the problem. Although this might take a little longer and it might be a little more awkward. I'm really hoping that everybody here can see that this is kind of the desirable end. This is the one you should be aiming for, because some people get stuck at the first stage of toughing it out and then they progress to the second stage and they get stuck there. Really, the idea is that you work through till you get to this final stage involving recovery. In The Myth of Mental Illness, Thomas Sowers says something very interesting. This is what he says. The pancreas may be said to have a natural function. But what is the natural function of the person? That is like asking what is the meaning of life, which is a religious, philosophical, not medical, scientific question. And this is exactly where Father Chad Ripperger comes into the scene with his book, Introduction to the Science of Mental Health. And that is this book. Just have a look at that. It's the biggest. Thank you. This book is a little bit different from the other two I have been talking about. It is not an easy read. It is a big, thick book with a hard cover. And inside there are some big, thick ideas, some of which also have a hard cover. But it is the most rewarding book I have ever read on mental health and mental illness. This book has everything. It answers Saz's question on what the natural function of the person is in spades. It's got the sacraments, the virtues, the spiritual life, temperaments, sins, everything, angels, demons, but it's got all of this focused on the relationship between these things and a person's mental health. Now, obviously, we are not going to cover all of this tonight because it is a very big, thick book, but what I want to do is just give you an introduction to some of Ripurge's key ideas. This book doesn't have an index, but it does have a very, very detailed table of contents. What I recommend if you get this book is look at the table of contents and pick the first thing that interests you, because there's tons of little sections in this book, and you just run your eye down the table. Don't pick it up and try and start at the beginning, because the first volume is all Aquinian theology and ontology, and you'll die. You will seriously die. I almost died until I figured out about the table of contents. Like, oh, demons, I'll read about that. And so in I went, and I read about the demons, and I thought, wow, that's really interesting. Wow, 15 signs of demonic activity in my life. Wow. And that was, it was great. And then I was hooked, you know, and I started looking up other things. And so if you do it that way, if you read according to your interest, you will get into this book, and you will end up reading the whole thing because you'll get used to the language. There's an index of language at the back, the glossary at the back, because some of the terms are a bit freakish, but that's okay. It's sort of heavy theology. So that's what I would do if you're going to get a copy of this book. That's how I'd approach it. Ripurge has spent 20 years reading and writing and talking and teaching about this stuff and about the Catholic approach to psychology and psychiatry and where it has been lacking. And his first and most important point in his writings is this: effective psychology must proceed from an authentic knowledge of the human person. And this is why contemporary psychology and psychiatry get it wrong. How do they get it wrong? Well, we can best show this when we look at the various attempts that various people have made to draw a map of the human person that includes their mind, that includes the sort of the bit of us that we can't put our finger on. How do you draw a human being? This is one way you can do it. This is the central nervous system. Isn't that interesting? Not really. It's a sort of physical biomedical model of the human person. Emotions don't really feature too strongly there, but we certainly know about the mechanics of it. You can do something like this. This is the limbic system in your brain. This is the seat of the emotions in the human brain. Again, fascinating. Hippocampus, just what everyone needs. And we've all got one, and it's a wonderful thing. You know, love your hippocampus. Cherish it, because it's really linked to your mood, and it's fantastic. But again, there's quite a lot of parts of the human person missing from that drawing. This, I love this one. This is like a little computer drawing of how you think. Isn't that gorgeous? It's got a little machine down the bottom showing how it just makes no sense at all. But that's actually, it's a functional model, of mental action. It's a bit soulless though. So let's look at the people who like to draw souls. We'll start with our friend Freud. And this is called the egg. That's what Freudians call it, because it's egg-shaped. This is the Freudian model of the human person. There's something quite major missing from there, and that is the body. Because this is all about what's going on in your head. And, of course, Jung had to have a crack after that, and his is circular. And, again, the body is conspicuous by its absence from these models. So we can't seem to find anyone who can put the two together. I did find some, but they were from the Swedenborgians, and I didn't think I wanted to show you those because they were really, really strange and really didn't make any sense at all. It involved aliens, and it wasn't good. So I just kept moving, and that was all fine. Now, Ripurge says back in the 20s and 30s when Freud and Jung were drawing these circles and what have you, this is when the Catholic Church actually began a really good discussion with secular psychology. But then Catholic scholars dropped the ball and tried to fit in too much with secular science. And we are still seeing the effects of this today. It's really hard to get theology back on the psychological table to talk about it, simply because it was wiped out for so many years. So Ripurge decides he's going to take up where these scholars left off. But, of course, now he's got a much better knowledge of the limitations of these particular models and also of psychiatric research. And the first thing he does is try to map what the human person really looks like. Are you ready for this? It's a little bit scary, but I don't want anyone to panic. There. That's not so bad, is it? It's got a few arrows, but that's okay. This is based 100% on the work of Thomas Aquinas, and it's a far more accurate image of what the human person really is. There's a body there, there's also a soul, but they're not split apart from each other because we can't split them apart from each other while we're living in them. We've got reason, we've got free will, we've got intellect, imagination, memory, appetites. We've got a whole lot of stuff on that chart. And by using this approach, Ripperger is able to uncover some very profound truths about human beings and their mental health. This is the bit that lights up like a Christmas tree when we have psychological problems. Now, before you panic and think this book is all about like going to confession more and then you'll get better, and if you're not, you're probably possessed, nothing could be further from the truth. Even though Ripperger is a working exorcist, he's apparently much in demand, it's actually not as easy as that. Ripperger defines mental health as a person's right use of the intellect and the will. We're just going to look at that. There we go. I've simplified it a bit so you can see there's the intellect and the will. They've got an interrelationship. These are probably the two most underrated parts of the human person in our modern age. We know all about the body and we know all about the emotions. We can talk about them all the time. In fact, we do. But we almost never talk about the intellect and the will anymore. It's like they don't exist. Ripperger argues, exactly like Szasz and Deutsch, that the life choices we make, the big ones and the small ones, lead either to mental health or mental illness. Our choices are influenced by our will and reason, but also by these babies down here, our appetites. That's where our emotions sit, and that's where you get your passions, your love, hate, desire, fear. All of those things live down there. These push us and pull us. And because they're affected by concupiscence, they don't always incline us to do the right thing. Mental health and mental illness are all about our relationship with truth. We are designed by God to thrive on truth, to love it, to absorb it, to chew it over with our God-given reason. Truth is reality. People who experience mental problems often have grave difficulty facing and accepting truth and reality. And this is not just a symptom of the problems, it's actually a cause of them as well. In order to be mentally healthy, we need to have a love of the truth. And sometimes that means facing very uncomfortable truths in our own lives. Ripperger identifies three categories of causes of mental illness. See, he's not scared to actually assign causes to mental illness. And they he names nature, technology, and human relations as the exterior causes, and the other two are ourselves, just our person, and angels and God. The three exterior causes are very interesting. Human relations, particularly, is the one where you really need to sit up and take notice, because it's in our human relationships that our mental health principally thrives and suffers. We are social beings, and our mental health is intimately connected to our relationships with other people. And those closest to us, parents, siblings, spouses, children, are naturally the ones who have the most powerful effect on us and upon our mental health. And that effect can be for good or it can be for bad. Our interior senses, such as our memory, can be the cause of mental distress as well, especially if there's been trauma. Bad memories can affect a person's judgment of present-day situations and people. And this reminds me of a very good description I once read of our emotional problems as unpaid bills. People with emotional baggage, which is pretty much everyone in this room, myself included, tend to go around presenting these unpaid emotional bills to the other people in our lives. A person's drive to have these bills can get really out of control, and it can lead them to choose particular friends or particular jobs or lines of work or particular spouses. But if the bills can't be paid, if the person chose wrongly, or, you know, had unrealistic expectations about that bill being paid, and it can't be paid by the friend or the job or the spouse, then the fighting starts in earnest. The imagination is another very powerful factor, especially as today we're encouraged not to keep the slightest control of our imagination whatsoever. In fact, we're encouraged to let it run amok. And if we end up with a weak will and a weak reason, then the imagination does run amok, and it runs usually down one path. And that one path is fear. Our imaginations love fear. Many common mental disorders are based on fear. Problems like anxiety, obsessive compulsion, phobias, paranoia, all of these things are fueled by fear and by an uncontrolled imagination. At the very least, if you have an uncontrolled imagination, you're going to get problems like hyperactivity, concentration problems, excessive impulsivity, delusions. An uncontrolled imagination pours petrol on the fire of the emotions so that a person's behaviour becomes dominated by the emotions instead of by their reason. And finally, we've got something else called cogitation, cogitative power. This is our ability to chew things over and process data. If we use this properly, we can use it to think our way out of problems and difficult situations. But if we misuse it, or it becomes very damaged by sin, then that's where we get fixations and rumination and obsessions. They all come when that particular function gets affected. Isn't that interesting? This is like a blast of fresh air to me. I must say, I'd never read anything like this. So I find, those of you who are older and who, you know, have studied Thomas Aquinas will just be sitting there thinking, huh, I knew all of that. But I didn't, and a lot of other people don't either. So this is really very new. I find this very interesting because cognitive behavioural therapy uses all of these functions to treat people. It uses a person's memory, their imagination, and their cogitation, and it retrains them so that the person stops sliding into those old, unhelpful ways of thinking. Therapists are using something we already have, a function or a capacity that all of us have, actually to help us heal. And the best thing about this diagram is where the will is located. You will notice it's right at the top. That's because there are some one-way streets and two-way streets in the human psyche. Here are some of the two-way streets. The will works with the reason, and the memory works with the imagination, and you can see where they're basically there's some to-ing and fro-ing going on there. There are also some very important one-way streets in a healthy human psyche, and they all proceed from the will. The human will is the most powerful tool you have to restore your mental health. You are quite seriously in the driver's seat here. This is authentically person-centered mental health care. It doesn't get much more personal than this. Now you'll notice the arrows go downwards from the will through the imagination to the appetites. Not the other way round, because if you do it the other way round, you are in a lot of trouble, and that's when you will lose your mental health. Ripperger is very direct. If you want to maintain your mental health, you cannot lead a life governed by your appetites and emotions. These appetites don't have to be, by the way, for the obvious things like sex and drugs and alcohol and fast cars and what have you. An appetite is a desire for any perceived good. Sleep, attention, money, marriage, watching sport on television, reading books. It can be any kind of desire for any perceived good. Sex is important. It is a uniquely problematic area for human beings, and it always has been, and it always will be. It is not going to get better, folks. I'm sorry. I wish I could tell you that, you know, in 10 years' time we will have evolved out of this, but we're not going to have evolved out of it at all. Ripperger explains why sex is so critical to mental health. It's such a vehement force that it has a profound effect on the appetites, the imagination, the memory, the intellect, and the will, on the whole box and dice there. When you use it properly in marriage, it provides powerful benefits to all of those domains. And when you misuse it, it has the power to do damage across all of those domains. Misused sexuality, says Ripperger, is always psychologically damaging to the persons involved, whether they feel damaged or not. Because the emotions are sitting right down the bottom, they are the least important part of this. So that brings us to our old friend. What about angels and demons as the cause of mental illness? Well, Ripperger says, yes, it does happen. These types of interventions do happen. They're perfectly real. But you cannot hide behind the devil unless you are a case of bona fide possession. Do not try to blame the devil for your mental health problems otherwise. Ripperger explains the limitations of angelic and demonic activity in our lives. He points out that we have far more free will than we'd probably like, because it's so much easier to blame the devil for all our poor choices. However, if you really do want to keep the devil out of your life, you do have to be more careful about using your senses properly, because he says misuse of the senses will get demonic influence into your life quicker than anything else. So what you're watching and what you're reading, what you're listening to, what you're looking at, what you're thinking about on a regular basis. Ripperger says, and I quote, mental illnesses almost always are the result of the person not relating properly to some created thing. Living our life according to our appetites, no matter how harmless the appetite might seem, does cause us to disconnect from reality. Because all our appetites really want is the thing they're after. And any attempt to thwart them is perceived by us as suffering. We don't like it. And when you can't get what you want, you get angry because you're getting thwarted. And anger is another excellent cause of mental illness. So we're starting to build up a slightly familiar looking list here. We've got pride that puts the fulfillment of our personal appetites at the centre of our universe. And then when we get thwarted, we get angry. And if we misuse our sexuality, then we have lust. And if you want what you can't have, that's envy and avarice. And if your life is governed by your appetites, then you tend to end up with sloth and gluttony. Is it any wonder that these are called the seven deadly sins? They don't just kill your soul, they destroy you psychologically as well. Of course they do. How could they not? So unromantic as it seems, the principal root cause of mental illness is sin, both original sin, which we can't do much about because we're stuck with it, and actual or personal sin. Now, this should not come as a surprise to anyone in this room, because we all know that sin is a destructive force in our lives. It undoes our peace of mind. It undoes our happiness because it undoes our relationship with God. Ripperger has a brilliant section in this book on conscience and the way in which a guilty conscience, whether the person recognises their conscience as guilty or not, can create real psychological distress. So, is it just a question of going to confession and all your mental illness goes away? Well, you should always go to confession, but it's actually not that simple. Ripperger says that the best way to resolve mental problems with confession is to go to confession for supernatural reasons. Don't go there looking for a solution to your mental problems. A priest can't absolve you from mental problems, but he can absolve you from actual, specific, named sins. Focus on the real reasons for confession, says Ripperger: forgiveness, reconciliation, atonement, purification, humiliation. And if you seek these first, there will be a positive flow on to your mental health. Ripperger is very, very honest about the lived experience of mental illness, and he says repeatedly in this book that what holds many people back from complete healing is that some aspects of mental illness are enjoyable. Now, this is just about the most countercultural thing you can say, and people always go, "Ooh," when I say this, but our whole secular discourse around mental illness is that it's an affliction. It's something, you know, you don't choose it. It happens to you, and it's not your fault, and you're the victim of it, and everybody feels very sorry for you. And yet, anyone who's had a mental illness themselves or maybe is very close to someone who's been diagnosed with something may recognise this uncomfortable truth about certain enjoyment taking place there. How does a person enjoy a mental illness? Well, Ripperger tells us, and in fact he comes back to this point a lot in this book, which is very interesting. He says that human beings develop attachments to pleasures, even if the pleasure seems very odd to other people. For example, some people, not all of them, but some people with depression, he says, have a strong attachment to the pleasure of sadness. What is the pleasure of sadness? It's actually something we all know about. Ripperger uses the example of when you are having a good mope and someone comes along and tries to cheer you up. Very often our reaction is to tell them to go away, sometimes quite rudely, and stop trying to cheer us up. This is an example of how quite regular people can sometimes prefer being sad to being happy, because our will says to us that we are enjoying our mope. We don't want to be dictated to by that cheerful person who is annoying, and that cheerful person is annoying us, and we want them to go away. In a person who has become strongly attached to the pleasure of sadness, this kind of reaction can become a habit that is very difficult to break. It becomes comfortable in an uncomfortable kind of way, or uncomfortable in a comfortable kind of way, if you prefer. Other people, you might find that they've formed an attachment to the pleasure of expressing anger and rage. Sometimes you see this with some personality disorders. Sometimes it's the pleasure of gaining control over other people and gaining like a lever with which to manipulate people. People who felt powerless suddenly have control. Sometimes it's the pleasure of indulging in fear. And don't tell me you don't know what that is, because anybody here who's seen a scary movie knows all about the pleasure of fear, something we all, you know, get a bit of a thrill out of. If a person wants to become mentally healthy again, Ripurgis says, they must decide, using their intellect and their will, to break that habit and walk away from that pleasure, because it's destructive and it's keeping them trapped in a state of mental illness. So what about the person whose mental illness has been caused by other people, by their abuse or their neglect or their assault? Well, the first thing to remember here is that there are two people involved. There's the assailant and there's the assailed. If the person who's being assailed has good resilience, they can actually tolerate a far higher degree of assault than a person with no resilience, which is why some people can go through all kinds of terrible experiences and remain quite stable, whereas other people can have quite a slight knock, but they'll suffer very grievous damage from it. Now, it's not up to us to judge people as being weak or being strong or anything like that. It's much more helpful to teach people about resilience and how to develop it. That's really the most constructive thing you can do, rather than blaming someone for being weak. The solution to wounds caused by other people is, oh, you're going to love this, the practice of the most difficult of Christian virtues, and it begins with an F. It's the F word, forgiveness. Forgiveness. Horrible, horrible, difficult thing to do, but wonderful, but horrible. Forgiveness is often confused with reconciliation. This is what holds a lot of people back from doing it, because they think they have to go and kiss and make up with the person who's, you know, molested them or whatever. Forgiveness is not the same as reconciliation. Forgiveness can and often has to be one-sided. Now, forgiveness itself is a very complex topic, and I'm not going to go into it into too much detail. What I would like to tell you, though, is that secular psychologists are now using programs that incorporate forgiveness techniques, and they find that these bring measurable and lasting improvements to their clients, way over clients who use other programs. So if secular psychologists have figured out that forgiveness works, maybe Catholics could give it a try. The first and hardest thing for a lot of good Catholic people is to identify the person who needs forgiving and for what. That's because it's someone very near and dear to them. It's a parent or parents, it's a child, a sibling, it's their spouse, and it's very painful to have to admit that. Of course, some people go to the other delightful extreme and blame everybody for everything, and we've probably met these people as well. Either way, if you want healing, you have to accurately identify the specific wrong and then pray for the grace you need to forgive that wrong. And then while you're at it, you can pray to be forgiven as well for the damage that you've done to other people that you might have forgotten about in your pain, because there's probably that lurking under there as well. Finally, Ripurgis has some very firm words about adult responsibility. If we have suffered from defects caused by other people's failings, it is our responsibility to clean it up, since the kind of person that we are is ultimately determined by our choices. So by way of conclusion, all I want to say is that I think Ripurgis has got a kind of unified field theory here, which helps to explain why so many people are affected by mental illness all around us. It's like an epidemic. We live absolutely immersed in a culture that prizes sensuality, sexual autonomy, uncontrolled emotion, sloppy thinking, sentimentality, childishness, victimhood, everything you can imagine, and we have a pretty lousy educational standard as well, which helps to keep all of that in place. We are no longer used to suffering of any kind. I always bring up the example of Don Chipper's ads. When was the last time you saw a coffin in one of those ads? You won't see it. You'll see flowers and people having their hand patted. You won't see a coffin because that means there's a dead body. And yet, of course, this is a funeral director, you know, advertising his product. You will never see a coffin in a Don Chipper ad. We are so cushioned from the realities of life, like sickness and death, almost all of the time. And against this backdrop, all you have to do is throw in some drugs and alcohol and you have yourself a real problem. And against this backdrop, many Catholics are now absolutely indistinguishable. Because Catholics who live and breathe and act like pagans for 6 days and 23 hours a week might find that while they love the lifestyle because it's great, they and their children seem to be taking on some of its adverse consequences as well. And this is going to include mental problems. It is hardly surprising. When did you last give thanks to God for the gift of your human reason? When did you last even remember that you had human reason, that you had an intellect and a will? When was the last time you heard a sermon on it? When was the last time you gave a sermon on it, fathers? I'm not picking on you. If anyone wants to know churches where they can hear sermons on this, please see me afterwards because I'll give you a list. It's actually, there's lots. And it's really good. So there are some very unfashionable spiritual realities like, you know, fortitude and the benefits of suffering. And so it's not often you get to hear that these days, which is kind of a shame. What I find most powerful and most valuable about Ripurge's approach is that it turns out that people with mental problems suffer from the same difficulties and battles and temptations as everybody else. We are actually all in this together. And things like self-denial and detachment and mortification and patience and all of those unfashionable things turn out to be really good frontline treatments for all of us. I think Ripurge's approach also offers us hope. A person with mental and emotional problems who wants to overcome them can do so using this kind of methodology. But to do this, they need to identify the real issues that are in their heart and pray for the specific graces that they need. It might be fortitude, it might be patience, might be forgiveness. Every single person in this room has to do the same thing if you want to keep your mental health and maintain it. C.S. Lewis was a wonderful writer, and he kind of sums up for me, so I'm just going to read you, by way of ending, a little thing from what he says about mental problems in his book Mere Christianity, which I hope many of you have read. He says this: "Do not despair. He knows all about it. You are one of the poor whom he blessed. He knows what a wretched machine you are trying to drive. Keep on. Do what you can. One day he will fling it on the scrap heap and give you a new one. And then you may astonish us all, not least yourself, for you have learned your driving in a hard school." Thank you.
That was Dr. Philippa Marta with Catholic Spirituality and Mental Health. For more, visit DawsonSociety.com.au or cradio.org.au.